And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. In this part of the hour, we explore a debate that was alive and well in the 17th century, that's the 1600s, and now it's true again in the 21st century, that's the 2000-odds. And are we saving the world by cleaning up the planet with man-made technology, or is the planet only savable by man butting out entirely? And we'll explore this big question with Anthony Funari, an adjunct professor of English at Johnson County Community College. Mr. Funari will be giving a book talk on Thursday, December 8th at 7 p.m. at the Hudson Auditorium in the Nerman Museum at Johnson County Community College. The event is free and open to the public. You are focusing on Sir Francis Bacon in your book and with your suppositions connecting the Gulf oil spill to his very old but very resonant thoughts. How can we apply Sir Francis Bacon's suppositions, Anthony Funari, to thoughts around the BP Gulf oil spill, the technological failures that have disastrous environmental implications?
Well, first off, thank you so much for having me today. I guess if we look back to that ecological tragedy, there's one moment that particularly stands out, and it's BP's decision to use the chemical dispersants on the oil that was gushing up from the oil head. And they decided to use between 1.5 and 1.6 million gallons of Corexit 9500 and 9527. And what's intellectually interesting about that moment is that this particular technology was very, very little studied. In 2005, the National Research Council actually came out in a report and said that the long-term health and environmental effects of this technology have not been studied enough to confidently endorse it. So endorse its use during an oil spill. So here was a moment that we were actually using our technology unscientifically. And I like to think of this, or I do believe, that part of the motivation behind BP's using this technology was a belief, a cultural belief that, you know, we have the technological power to sort of restore nature, to redeem our environmental sins in a way. And I think this cultural belief can be traced back to Francis Bacon, the 17th century, philosopher.
Now, there are some people that might tell you, the name of your book is, by the way, is Francis Bacon and 17th Century Intellectual Discourse.
Mm-hmm.
Snappy title.
You're right.
But some people might say, to what you just said, that Sir Francis Bacon's approach with the scientific method, he's known for the mm-hmm. scientific method, hypotheses and inferences, mm-hmm. educated guesses, in other words. Some mm-hmm. people might say that these BP and all of these companies that were involved, Transocean, were making educated guesses.
Yes. I mean, they were partly educated guesses. But I would have to really think that, with the decisions to use the chemical dispersants, how do I say this best? There was evidence to suggest not using them too, and that it became a decision on BP's part. And I really think that it was more motivated by, again, a belief rather than just a science based off of science. Because what we saw after BP's use of them was that the sort of scientific discussion then started to occur. We saw this debate happening in the newspapers. Well, what's happening with these chemical dispersants? What's effect is it actually having on the environment? And this discussion only happened after the fact, really.
And then they were using hair and stockings, basically, to clean up the oil.
Right. It was this sort of fog of war, this confusion that was an anxiety and haste that really characterized BP's response.
So tell us about Sir Francis Bacon's scientific approach as a scientific propagandist. And what did that entail?
Well, if we look back at Francis Bacon, I mean, he was not a Robert Boyle or a Sir Isaac Newton. He didn't actually come up or formulate a law of nature. What he did was he came up with the intellectual framework for modern scientific thought. And part in promoting this was his writing a type of narrative, a story, if you will, that, human learning and scientific advancement was partly, to gain control over nature but it was also sort of a return in a way. It was a return back to an earlier moment, an earlier what he saw as a moment where we had this sort of harmony between humanity and nature that was kind of represented for Bacon in the Garden of Eden.
Is this idea of restoring nature mm-hmm. through science? Is that what a lot of Bacon's writings are based on, sort of coming back to man's dominion over beasts of the field, fowls of the air, as it were?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, for Bacon, it was about, you know, we see science as discovery, always moving forward, always coming up with something new. And for Bacon, it was more about recovery. It was more about regaining the power that humanity once held over nature, and that nature was seen in a sort of state of rebellion for Bacon and for his contemporaries. And what Bacon thought was that through adopting a scientific approach, we can bring harmony back to nature, that nature was there for our management.
Now, Mr. Fernard, we saw a lot of technological innovation in the last 10 years, and we've seen a lot of, just in this year alone, 2011, a lot of natural disasters the world over. Mm-hmm. Based on your work, it sort of develops into two schools of thought, the first being technology, environmental harmony can come from technological innovation, but hasn't this already proved untrue?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if we can't, there, as you were saying, there are two basic schools of thought when it comes to modern environmentalism. There was this the sense of the technofix school, you know, the belief that environmental harmony is going to come through technology, through innovation, that we're going to reconcile our economic wants with our environmental obligations through invention. But there's that counter school that suggests what we really need to establish environmental harmony is to treat nature ethically, to not see it there for our benefit, that it exists outside of us, independent of us. And I think you're absolutely right in noting that, you know, these environmental disasters that have occurred over and over again, you know, sort of disproving Bacon's narrative, Bacon's ideas, Bacon's belief that, you know, through technology, we can regain control over nature.
So how do we redeem Bacon's thoughts in this context with the post-scientific or radical dream green generation with this human hubris? How can we reconcile that?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if we can. I mean, with Bacon, I don't think it's this idea that we can. Let me try this and try a different answer approach to that. I mean, for Bacon, you know, it would have been unthinkable that we could ever really victimize nature. I mean, nature for Bacon was in charge. You know, and the idea that we could somehow through our carelessness destroy nature was, I would say, a foreign concept to him. And now that we're seeing today that we do have that power, you know, we do have that ability, I think that, you know, it's that we can't really reconcile Bacon's narrative, that we have to adopt a new one.
And that new one is the sort of framework that you discuss in your book and that you will be discussing on Thursday here.
Yes.
Is hubris and self-importance among both modern scientific thinkers and modern religious scholars, theological scholars, is that the reason why some of this is still a sort of no-brainer when it comes to new ideas? Talk about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, what we kind of see here, particularly with Bacon and on through up to today, is that we like to have that comforting sort of tale that we're in charge. You know, nature is not beyond our control. You know, we're the dominant players here. And I think, and that kind of speaks to that hubris, you know, that nature's for us, you know, that we are the central character here. And what we're seeing in certain schools of environmental thought is that we need to take a more decentered approach. We need to see nature as outside of us, as not something that we can dominate anymore, that we are not the central player in our environmental tale.
I think the key question, going back even past Bacon, was could we ever have dominated it? Take a deep breath.
Could we ever have dominated it? You know, I would have to say I don't think we could ever dominate it. You know, it's with one of the things that, you know, we look at the, you know, Gulf oil spill.
Exxon Valdez.
Exxon Valdez, absolutely. The Itox spill of 79. I mean, these were all examples of moments where, you know, it was proven that we don't have the abilities sometimes to manipulate nature for our benefit. You know, these are examples over and over again where we screw up, and that we don't have that ability to bring nature to our will.
Anthony Fenari is an adjunct professor of English at Johnson County Community College. He's using modern applications for the theories of Sir Francis Bacon to discuss the age-old conundrum of, are we saving the Earth, or is the Earth actually us that we save, or the ground we stand on? Mm-hmm. Very esoteric thoughts. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is KCUR, and we're streaming live on kcur.org. Now, Mr. Fenari, let's get back to Sir Francis Bacon. Among critics, Sir Francis Bacon was known as a chauvinistic, in Adam all men die approach. Mm-hmm. And given the religious fervor of that time and his time, too, is that your perception?
Yes, very, very, very much so. I mean, what we kind of see in Bacon's writings is this sort of overlay of religious rhetoric. Let me explain here. I mean, today we see science as separate from religion. You know, this two different areas of thought. For Bacon, you know, there was very much he adopted a lot of religious rhetoric. You know, in his writings, he talked about the Garden of Eden. He talked about idolatry. He talked very much about Genesis, was a book that he really loved to write about. And what I think we can see there is that he did really very much adopt or utilize some of the religious language that was predominant during his day.
Certainly. Paradise Lost and Canterbury Tales and a lot of that stuff was along that same millennial line.
Yes.
Within the last 500 years of that.
Mm-hmm.
So he almost had to, being a man of his time.
Absolutely. I mean, there's been this sort of debate, how sincere was he of a Christian, in a way, or a religious believer. He would later critics would accuse him of atheism and that, you know, he was just superficially using that rhetoric. I don't think that was the case at all.
What about his, as you say in your book, recovery?
Mm-hmm.
Of the lost heritage,
mm-hmm.
recovery of man's dominion.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. In the Renaissance, you know, we saw there was this very much look backwards. That, you know, particularly with the rediscovery, all this classical literatures, the writings of Aristotle and Plato, and there was this idea that humanity was on a decline. It was how do I say this best? It had its best days were behind it. And that we were slowly in a decline intellectually and so on. But for Bacon, he kind of wrote against that. And he saw humanity on the precipice of a really exciting era, you know, an era of recovery, of going back and gaining that control that was once man's, once humanity's, that once existed in the Garden of Eden. He actually says at one point in his really foundational work, the Novum Organum, or the New Tool, that he is looking to restore humanity to its God-given powers.
What did Bacon's contemporaries think?
Well, immediately after the publication of his most famous work, one of his rivals, Sir Edward Coke, came out and called the book, this is a boat for floating fools in. So there was a little bit of a backlash against Bacon's writings, but his ideas, Baconianism, becomes the predominant school of thought throughout the 17th century and really gives the foundation for what would become the scientific revolution. So in the decades following his death, we see this, you know, this sort of popularity in his writings. You know, people really, really latch onto his ideas about recovering a lost inheritance. Particularly, the Royal Society, one of the first scientific bodies, very much recognized Bacon as their foundational voice.
And how does Bacon's, you mentioned lost heritage, lost discovery, the lost city of Atlantis is a highly debated topic among historians, theologians even. How does Bacon's New Atlantis that came out, that you reference in your book, and that came out in 1627, how does that advance his theories, and how do you bring that forth to today?
Oh, well, you know, the New Atlantis was one, it was his utopian text. This is where he actually creates a scientific society based off of his writings and his philosophy. So he sort of gives this, how do I say this best, this out, this sort of outline for how a scientific society is going to look. And in his text, he writes about this House of Salem, or Solomon, excuse me. And this is basically this, you know, body of scientists who are learning how to manipulate nature. And what's kind of interesting is Bacon in that writing almost anticipates our understanding of genetics and genetic science. And so for someone reading that work today, they would very much recognize our modern research universities, and which there are, in a way, based off of, you know, what Bacon wrote in the New Atlantis.
Sir Francis Bacon's Renaissance period was a period where thinkers were moving past, or at least thinking that they were moving past, the Greco-Roman literature and theory, beyond that classic theory, into a new age. Explain that. Bring it forth to today.
Well, one of the really interesting things about that text, Novum Organum, is the frontispiece to it, the cover to it, is a picture of the Pillars of Hercules. Now, these were considered the geographical limits of the classical world. And on this picture, there are boats sailing beyond it, about to discover the new world. And so in choosing that as his cover piece, Bacon makes this sort of connection between what he's doing and what, say, Christopher Columbus was doing, this idea of moving past the classical world, both geographically in discovering the Americas, and intellectually in the in adopting scientific thought. So we see this idea of, you know, moving, that we see knowledge as something that's going to be progressive, that we move past. We move forward always. He has this great quote in the book where he says, "Truth is the daughter of time, not authority." So it's that this progressive understanding of always moving towards truth. And I really think we still have that today in our science. We always see science as moving forward, that always progressive, always accumulating in knowledge.
But if he says truth is the daughter of time and not authority, doesn't that sort of contradict some of the stuff he's saying, even down to the daughter?
Sort of. I mean, kind of. It's interesting to how he, this sort of very complex understanding of like human intellectual history. It's, you know, in some ways we're moving past the classical authors
and even the patriarchal system.
Yes. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of really great criticism out there that looks at how Bacon represents gender. Very much so. You know, there's a school of thought that kind of sees Bacon as, you know, suggesting we need to almost rape nature in a way, which
wow.
is really very, very controversial.
Wow. And so, there are environmentalists, I'm sure, that would say that about these oil spills, that would say that about strip mining and things of that nature.
Absolutely.
What's the relationship then when you talk about discovering America? That's the hubris, going back to the hubris of having discovered something that was already there and discovering it for your own means of commerce. The relationship between the advances of science and commerce in the Renaissance period, the merchants of Venice, as it were, Christopher Columbus came out of, the Queen Isabella exploration of gold in the New World. How does that resonate today with the oil exploration, with the mining and minerals exploration?
Well, I guess, you know, we can see this as – I guess I would say it would resonate today in the fact that we are still thinking that there's always something else to discover out there, right? There's always this moment of scientific discovery, always keep moving forward. And I think in that way, you know, we can still see, you know, science and like exploration still speaking to one another very much so.
I guess what I was trying to say was It was resources then, whether it be gold, silks, and spices. Mm-hmm. And it's resources now, whether it be oil, whether it be natural gas, whether it be rare earth minerals.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same deal. How is the relationship between scientific studies and literature advanced?
Ah, okay. I guess we might say that I would say that we see a little bit with regards to literature and literary studies and scientific studies that if we look at the two, literary studies can actually have a lot to offer with regards to our understandings of science and where science is progressing. You know, that the environmental conversations that were going on in Bacon's time and that came out of what Bacon wrote are still happening today. And that it might not be a bad idea to take a look back at what people were saying back then and might help us to advance our conversations.
And Anthony Fornari, what are you hearing from your students when you talk about this idea? When you say Sir Francis Bacon BP oil spill and you try to bring those seemingly unrelated subjects together, what is your student's reaction?
You know, I generally see with my students, when they read Bacon, and they always, some of them find him obviously speaking to ideas that are very familiar to them, the idea of scientific thought, of nature being sort of a treasure trove of resources for us and for our consumption. But then, you know, when we look after we read a little bit of Bacon, then when we look at, you know, what happened with BP, and I ask them to do a little bit of readings, they start to really question how whether that is the case anymore, you know, whether we really should see nature as something there for our, you know, consumption, for our industrial use. And they really start to see how, you know, the story that Bacon wrote, the narrative that he wrote, was still informing, BP's decision to drill in the Gulf and then to use these chemical dispersants. And they really, and making that connection, it kind of brings a text that was written nearly 400 years ago to have a little bit more life for them.
As a scholar and cultural critic and obviously human being, what does Anthony Fornari think? Can we control nature or do we just sit back and wait to simply adapt?
Oh, that's a really good question.
That's what we do.
Yeah, I know. As an environmentalist, I like to say that, you know, we need to adopt an ethical point of view, that we can't always rely on our technology to establish an environmental, you know, safe way of engaging nature, that we need to kind of drop our hubris in a way. But, you know, there's a lot of sacrifices that come with that. A lot of sacrifices.
That a lot of people aren't willing to make based on their conveniences.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's convenient and it's comforting to think that, you know, through our technology we'll be able to, you know, gain access to all what nature has to offer us. And when someone says we need to, maybe we can't do that, it's scary.
Our guest is Anthony Fornari, an adjunct professor of English at Johnson County Community College. Mr. Fornari will be giving a lecture on December 8th at 7 p.m. in the Hudson Auditorium of the Nerman Museum of the Johnson County Community College. The event is free and open to the public. Thank you for coming on. And tune in tomorrow for a look at two area organizations that are doing their part to help address the needs of KC's urban youth in the areas of childhood obesity, literacy, and youth violence. We have help today from Tamika Weatherspoon. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi. Up to Date is next with the Techspurts. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.